Welcome to The End of Innocence. I'm your host, John Young. At the beginning of this podcast, we set out to answer some of the most important questions about the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. The ideal is that we look and discuss things that happened before, during, and after the assassination that our history books or the Warren Commission didn't tell us. After all, for years the public has been told that there was one shooter, Lee Harvey Oswald, and he fired three shots from the Texas School Book Depository building. He then killed Dallas police officer J.D. Tippit and was running for his life on the streets of Dallas. He was arrested in the Texas theater, supposedly because he didn't buy a ticket to the movie, and then 2 days later he was shot by a lonely nightclub owner named Jack Ruby. The end. But as we have covered in 107 episodes now, there was a lot more to the story than we were told. But still, I get emails almost daily asking me the same question. What if Lee Harvey Oswald really was a lone shooter and the Warren Commission got it right? What then?
Answers unequivocally, Lee Harvey Oswald. Was Oswald acting alone, or was he a member of a conspiracy? Commission answers, he acted alone.
A couple of weeks ago, we did part one of a two-part series that we titled, What Warren Report Defenders and Supporters Must Believe in Order to Claim Lee Harvey Oswald Acted Alone or Even Was an Assassin at All in the Death of President John F. Kennedy. I'd planned on doing part two the following week, but felt like it was very important to bring our listeners and subscribers details from the latest hearing of the House Task Force on Declassification of JFK Files. So this week, we're doing part two of our mini-series. And I hope it stirs up the interest that part one did a couple weeks ago. If you didn't hear part one of the series, I would suggest that you go back and listen to episode 108 before listening to today's episode. As a Warren Report defender, you must accept that numerous witnesses are either mistaken or flat out lied. To illustrate, consider the fact that 43 individuals reported observing a right rear wound in the back of Kennedy's head, all of whom would have had to be incorrect or deceitful. Just to name a few of these people would be Deputy Sheriff Roger Craig, Gordon Arnold, Ed Hoffman, Richard Randolph Carr, Amos Ewens, Roy Cooper, Helen Forrest, Carolyn Walter, Victoria Adams, Sandra Stiles, Vicki Gardner, Carolyn Arnold, James Pennington, Arnold Rowland, Beverly Oliver, Gene Hill, Marvin Robertson, Officer Joe Smith, Deputy Constable Seymour Weissman, FBI agents Francis O'Neill and Vincent Drain, Bardwell Olden and James Siebert, Paul O'Connor, Dennis David, Joe O'Donnell, Tom Robinson, Darrell Tomlinson, Dr. Robert McClellan, Dr. Ron Jones, Dr. Kent Clark, Dr. Malcolm Perry, Dr. Marion Jenkins, Dr. Charles Baxter, and O.P. Wright. This is just to name a few. As a defender of the Warren Report, one must accept the official autopsy records over the medical accounts provided by Parkland Hospital doctors. This stance implies that the eight Parkland doctors who reported observing destroyed cerebellar tissue were mistaken, despite the fact that one of them held the position of chief of neurosurgery. Additionally, it necessitates disregarding the testimony of photographer John Stringer, who noted severe damage to the cerebellum in the brain he photographed.
Truck about where and pass about where?
From here.
Right. Through. And taking out the
back or the occipital part. The back of your head. This was gone in our view, and that's the reason we could see the cerebellum.
Dr. Perry was assuming the role of the primary surgeon, and as I walked by on the left side of the gurney the president was lying on, Dr. Perry leaned across and handed me a surgical retractor and said, Bob, would you go stand at the head of the cart and lean over and put this retractor in the wound in his neck where we're going to explore and do a tracheostomy.
Can you explain to for those of us that have asked what a retractor is?
Well, a retractor is a little metal surgical instrument, very simple little blade that has a little hook on the end of it, and you can put that in the edge of an incision and pull it open so the operating surgeon can see better down into the wound. So that put me at the head of the gurney, leaning over the president's head, looking down from about 18 inches into his head wound, in the back of his wound. So I had probably the best view of that massive wound in the back of his head from that position where I was helping Dr. Perry and Dr. Baxter do the tracheostomy and exploration of this wound.
There wasn't a doctor in the room who was probably closer to that massive head wound than you.
No. In fact, when I went and stood in that position, the first thing that kind of exclaimed out of my mouth was I said, "My God, have you seen the back of his head? It's gone." And Dr. Terrico said, "No, we just got here just ahead of you, and we haven't had time to look at anything except this wound in his neck." And I said, "Well, the back of his brain, the back half of his brain is gone." And as I stood there, just as I said that, the right half of the cerebellum, the back part of the brain, fell out of that massive wound in the back of his head onto the cart. So this was obvious that this was a fatal injury to the brain.
We've come up and back to see a village with guns, just real solid. And as if, his goal was part of the goal of it.
McClellan, I'm going to start with you because I know that you had some, in hearing what you're saying, you had some questions about the wounds and what has been described as a wound.
Right. And that's based mainly on two things. First of all, what I saw in the emergency room. And then a number of years later, when I first had the opportunity to see the Zapruder film and see several, showings of it, that altered what I came to think about the nature of the wounds and whether there was more than one shooter or simply one shooter. And what I saw in the Zapruder film was, as I'm sure many people have seen this film, as he's coming off of Houston Street on the Elm Street, heading toward the Triple Underpass, he's sitting next to Mrs. Kennedy, and they both look fine. Then just as they make that turn, as I'm sure everybody recollects, President Kennedy's hands go up to his neck. And so something has clearly happened at that time. And then the motorcade continues moving slowly down toward the Triple Underpass on Elm Street and disappears behind a large sign that was present at that time, is not there now. For a few moments, and then it proceeds out from behind that sign, and as the motorcade comes out from behind the sign, you see President Kennedy still has his hands up to his neck, and Mrs. Kennedy now has realized something has happened, and she's leaning over to him as if to say, "What's wrong?" Just as she does that, President Kennedy's head literally explodes, and he's thrown violently backward and to the left. And so that made me see that, as I saw that in several, run-throughs, that this looked like he was hit from one direction, from behind or above, with that first shot, and then that a shot came from in front and threw him violently backward and to the left. And that fit with what I saw, that massive wound low, not high, but low in the back of his head.
We heard Kennedy had been shot, and he was being brought to the emergency room at Parkland Hospital.
You just feel a flush coming over your body, and you think, "My goodness, I'm about to take care of the President of the United States."
Within minutes of seeing President Kennedy, doctors at Parkland concluded that the neck wound was an entrance wound, and the head wound was an exit wound.
The fatal wound came from the front, I think, and other people believe that too.
We thought that there was an entrance wound in the neck and an exit wound in the back of the head.
Parkland Hospital doctors reported to say they thought at least one bullet entered Mr. Kennedy's neck from the front.
Parkland doctors were a serious problem for the U.S. government. because they had provided evidence that there was a shooter somewhere in the front. And that ran totally contrary to the official narrative of a lone shooter from above and behind.
A lot of people just decided to keep their mouths shut, including the Parkland doctors.
What actually happened in trauma room one never came out, never became public.
I was there. I know what I saw.
I was there. I remember it in detail. It's etched in my memory forever.
In all probability, there was a conspiracy, i.e., there was more than one shooter.
The Parkland doctors told the truth. These doctors are about as trustworthy as you can get.
If you support the Warren Report, you would have to ignore evidence of a lower back wound, such as clothing, photos, witness statements, and reports. You would also overlook a video of Press Secretary Malcolm Kilduff pointing to his head and saying that Kennedy was shot in a bullet through the head.
John F. Kennedy died at approximately 1 o'clock Central Standard Time today here in Dallas. He died with a gunshot wound in the brain. Dr. Ferguson told me it's a simple matter, it's a bullet right through the head.
Additionally, you would dismiss that 7 Parkland doctors said Kennedy's throat wound was an entrance wound.
So, Perry, you were called into the emergency room. What did you do? What did you see? Newly arriving in the emergency room, I noted that the president had received a lethal wound. He was at that time under the care of Dr. James Clerico, who initially saw him as he entered the door. I was there approximately a minute or two later. There was no evidence to my attention of heartbeat or pulse, but he was attempting agonal respiration. I noted a wound of his neck and of his head, the latter being a quite massive wound. At that point, I started a tracheostomy to assist his respiration.
Did the president have a chance at all when he was brought in?
No, sir. In my opinion, the wound was a mortal one, and his chances for survival were none.
There were 2 bullet wounds that you saw.
There were 2 wounds. At the time, I could not tell for sure whether they would possibly have been made by 2 missiles or 1. It was my impression that there were 2 distinct wounds, one of the neck and one of the hip.
And these were large, massive wounds.
The wound of the neck was a small, penetrating wound, and appeared to be the entrance wound of one of the missiles. The wound of the head was a quite large wound. Could have been either an exit wound or a tangential wound of the skull.
Said we saw a little hole here, what appeared to be a bullet hole, about a quarter of an inch.
In his trachea. Yeah.
Well, next to his trachea.
Next trachea.
It involved his trachea, but it didn't go right through. It was just next to it.
Okay.
And the bullet hole was right where I'm pointing.
As a defender of the Warren Report, you have to not be suspicious about Kennedy's personal doctor, George Berkeley, contacting the House Select Committee on Assassinations to testify about his knowledge of a conspiracy and then changing his mind suddenly.
One physician present at both Parkland Hospital and the Bethesda Morgue was George Berkeley, Kennedy's personal doctor. Berkeley signed the autopsy descriptive sheet with a bullet in the back at the level of T3. He also signed Kennedy's death certificate, which also placed that wound in the back. Death certificate is not in the Warren Commission volumes. And the descriptive sheet in the commission volumes does not have Berkeley's signature. Our inspector did not depose George Berkeley. In 1977, through his lawyer, he wrote a letter to Richard Sprague, chief counsel of the House Select Committee on Assassinations. He said he had information indicating that others besides Oswald must have participated in the assassination. He was willing to talk about it at this time. Sprague, who made clear his intention to fully investigate the CIA's involvement, was forced out 2 weeks later. Dr. Berkeley submitted a written statement to the House Select Committee, but there is no official record of him being deposed as a witness.
In 1982, he told JFK researcher Henry Hurt, "I know there was more than one gunman." And when Henry Hurt tried to recontact Berkeley for more details, Berkeley cut him off at the knees. "I don't want to talk about it anymore." The very next year, Berkeley talked to Michael Kurtz, another JFK researcher, told him that he knew there was a conspiracy to kill the president and that he recalled an exit wound in the back of President Kennedy's head. Now, that's a very significant statement that the only doctor we know of who was present at both Parkland for treatment and at Bethesda during the autopsy told Michael Kurtz in 1983 that Kennedy had an exit wound in the back of his head. When Kurtz tried to recontact Berkeley, Berkeley cut him off the knees. "I don't want to talk about this anymore." Dr. Berkeley was deceased by the time the review board was impaneled. But then Jeremy decided, well, we can ask the executor of his estate, his daughter, sign a waiver so that we could go to the law firm that Mr. Illig used to work for, because he was deceased also, and see if there were any records in the file of Mr. Illig that would have revealed what it was he wanted to tell the HSCA in detail. And she said she would do that. And then Jeremy called her on the phone. She had completely changed her mind and adamantly refused to sign it and terminated the phone call.
Well, when I was a teenager, Dr. Berkeley and his family, four children, my father and our family of four children, shared a duplex, lived together at the Newport Naval Hospital. He had a son, George, who was my age, 16, and we became buddies. I looked him up again in 2012, and I asked him about what his dad had told him and his siblings about his role in the Kennedy case. That the only thing that he would say was that he couldn't understand why the Warren Commission never asked him to testify. Dr. Berkeley knew perfectly well why he wasn't asked to testify before the Warren Commission. The reason he didn't say anything to his children, he didn't want them to know that he was intimately involved in the cover-up. Dr. Berkeley's death certificate makes the single bullet theory bogus. The way the Warren Commission dealt with it was, they didn't publish the death certificate.
If the ARRB had been a criminal investigation, would you have granted Berkeley immunity for his testimony?
We should have redeposed Humes and Boswell after giving them immunity. And if Berkeley had still been around, he would have been another candidate because he was at the center of the photographic cover-up. By the way, George Berkeley was a rear admiral. He was promoted to vice admiral by Lyndon Johnson. So he promoted Berkeley to the highest possible rank, kept him on as military physician, and the last person to walk out of the White House with Lyndon Johnson the day he left office was George Berkeley.
If you support the Warren Report, you must overlook the bullet comparisons from the test and the nearly perfect condition of bullets CE-399. You would need to attribute the differences to varying bullet speeds based on the distances from which the gun was fired in the test compared to where Oswald supposedly fired from the 6-4 of the depository. You would also need to believe that this one bullet, CE-399, caused 7 wounds in 2 men and was then found in almost pristine condition.
The FBI concluded that all 3 bullets struck inside the car.
The Warren Commission put itself in a straitjacket. They could not possibly allow more than 3 shots because 4 shots or more would have clearly indicated conspiracy, and they were not going there.
That was heading down under the underpass, and there was very little blood where it would have struck.
Records show the first shot had missed its target completely, and the final shot hit Kennedy in the head. So how does one account for one bullet hitting 2 victims and doing all this damage? Arlen Specter was a Yale Law School graduate working in the Philadelphia District Attorney's Office when he was asked to serve on the Warren Commission.
Uh-huh. What if one bullet made all 7 wounds? Arlen Specter, he is the one that gave birth to the single bullet theory. What if one bullet went into Kennedy's back and came out his neck? And then went into Connolly's back, piercing the lung, destroying 4 inches of the right fifth rib, exiting from the front of his chest, going into the back of the wrist, shattering the distal end of the radius, and a 6'4" guy like Connolly, that's a big heavy bone, comminuted fracture, exits from the front of the wrist, goes into his left thigh. Whatever you want, whatever you need, this bullet happily and readily obliges you. It is indeed a magic bullet.
CE-399 was the magic bullet, and all government investigations so far have treated that bullet as absolutely foundational to this case.
Years since former President John F. Kennedy was assassinated while driving through downtown Dallas. It is a historic event that has fueled theories and conspiracies for decades about what exactly happened.
Now with modern technology, an engineering and animation lab has found something new that they say proves the single bullet theory is wrong. True Crime correspondent Brianna Whitney is here now to show us what the lab found, and this could alter history.
It sure could. This could be a big deal. The Warren Commission, who investigated the assassination after the fact,
found the bullet first struck President Kennedy is the same bullet that then went through Texas Governor John Connally, who was sitting in the front passenger seat of the limousine. This is widely known as the magic bullet or the single bullet theory. But this lab claims after years of research, the same bullet hitting both men is scientifically impossible.
November 22nd, 1963, hundreds lined the streets of Dallas to see JFK and First Lady Jackie O. Then, one of the country's most famous tragedies, President Kennedy shot twice by Lee Harvey Oswald. Walter Cronkite coming on the air.
President Kennedy died 1 p.m. Central Standard Time.
The Warren Commission was tasked with investigating and presenting the findings of the shooting. They found JFK was shot twice from behind by Lee Harvey Oswald from the sixth floor of the Texas School Book Depository, and that the bullet that struck John F. Kennedy in his neck is the same bullet that struck and went through Governor John Connally, who was sitting in the passenger seat in front of JFK.
Now, what we've gone through so far is that those can't be the same bullet. They don't align. We can't make Governor Connally's position match.
Stanley Stoll is CEO of Knott Laboratory, a forensic engineering and animation lab who was hired by a former Justice Department attorney to re-examine the single bullet theory. They took laser scanners to Dealey Plaza, then brought it back to their computers. And the data they collected from the lasers are tiny points, millions of them, to make a point cloud.
It's a digital twin. It's bringing the field to your computer, you know, the exact replica of whatever you wanted to scan. Everything used to be two-dimensional, and what you saw on camera may or may not be accurate. Now you can truly analyze it.
They then took the infamous Zapruder film that has the clearest video of when John F. Kennedy was shot and matched it to their point cloud. Everything was matching up perfectly until the Texas governor was shot too, reportedly by the bullet that went through the president first.
Through the evaluation comes to show is that those aren't in line. Governor Connally, his wound is sitting, 6 to 10 inches towards the outside of the vehicle. You have to slide Governor Connally to the inside of the vehicle. You have to slide him to the left to get that alignment.
Based on those findings, Stoll says you have to look at a new hypothesis that there was a second bullet. Question, from where?
So now a single bullet remains. A single bullet now has to account for the remaining seven wounds in Kennedy and Connally. But rather than admit to a conspiracy or investigate further, the Warren Commission chose to endorse the theory put forth by an ambitious junior counselor, Harlan Specter, one of the grossest lies ever forced on the American people. We've come to know it as the magic bullet theory. The magic bullet enters the president's back, headed downward at an angle of 17 degrees. It then moves upwards in order to leave Kennedy's body from the front of his neck. Wound number two, where it waits 1.6 seconds, presumably in midair, where it turns right, then left, right, then left, and continues into Connally's body at the rear of his right armpit. Wound number three. The bullet then heads downward at an angle of 27 degrees, shattering Connally's fifth rib and exiting from the right side of his chest. Wound number four. The bullet then turns right and re-enters Connally's body at his right wrist. Wound number five. Shattering the radius bone, the bullet then exits Connally's wrist. Wound number six. Makes a dramatic U-turn and buries itself into Connally's left thigh. Wound number seven, from which it later falls out and is found in almost pristine condition on a stretcher in a corridor of Parkland Hospital. That's some bullet. Anyone who's been in combat will tell you never in the history of gunfire has there been a bullet this ridiculous. Yet the government says it can prove it with some fancy physics in a nuclear laboratory. Of course they can. Theoretical physics can prove that an elephant can hang from a cliff with his tail tied to a daisy. But use your eyes, your common sense. The Army wound ballistics experts at Edward Arsenal fired some comparison bullets. Not one of them looked anything like this. Take a look at CE-856, an identical bullet fired through the wrist of a human cadaver. Just one of the bones smashed by the magic bullet. Seven wounds, gentlemen. Tough skin. Fenced bones. This single bullet explanation is the foundation of the Warren Commission's claim of a lone assassin. And once you conclude the magic bullet could not create all seven of those wounds, you have to conclude that there was a fourth shot and a second rifle.
As a defender of the Warren Report, you have to think that everyone's watches were wrong about the timing of the J.D. Tippit murder.
The Warren Commission said that Tippit was cruising slowly down a street on East 10th Street in Oak Cliff, which is a suburb of Dallas. It's across a viaduct from downtown. And happened to see a pedestrian. He pulled over the pedestrian, who he started to question the guy who unexpectedly shot him. But there are different versions from witnesses of which direction the guy was walking in, which is important because, for one thing, what rules Oswald out as a shooter was that he was seen at his rooming house in Oak Cliff at 104 by his housekeeper. And it's 0.9 miles away from where Tippit was shot. And if Oswald walked that distance, I've walked that distance many times, as have other researchers, and it's about a 15-minute walk. And so he couldn't have gotten there in time to shoot Tippit. Tippit died at probably 109, and that's established by a number of parameters. And some people even say 106, 107, but probably 109. The Warren Commission changed it to approximately 115 to make it just barely possible for Oswald to get there, but he couldn't have done that. The only way Oswald could have been there is if somebody drove him, which is possible, but I have no evidence of that. He was probably already at the movie theater. He was seen by a worker at the theater. It's going into the Texas Theater, not too far away, at about 1 o'clock to 107. So it wasn't Oswald, so who was it?
You also have to think that Aquila Clemons and Frank Wright were either lying or confused about what they saw, and that Warren Reynolds being shot in the head was just a coincidence, and he was wrong to think that it was connected with the assassination in any way.
And the timeline that they have to put together, the Warren Commission, is the entire crazy pretzel logic of trying to construct a timeline for Oswald every waking minute of that day. And when they don't have a timeline, is they have to monkey around with the time of death to make it fit into Oswald's timeline, because we know Oswald was back at his rooming house at 1 o'clock. We know that because the housekeeper was watching CBS News, News of Our Lives, that's interrupted by a CBS News bulletin. We know the time of the bulletin. We know what time Oswald shows up. How he gets there is another mystery, because he allegedly takes a bus and then gets into the cab. And the Warren Commission is trying to get him to the 1 o'clock meeting. But the situation at the rooming house, where Earlene Roberts, the housekeeper, sees him, that's kind of like a touchstone, because that's like she sees him get into his coat. She sees him leave. She sees him go to the bus stop across the street, and it's like 1:04. So we know what time Oswald gets to the rooming house. We know what time he's across the street. And we know that he's going to get to the Texas Theater to see the Twin Bill with Van Heflin, War is Hell. And Oswald literally has 10 minutes or 8 minutes to go a mile from his house to the location of the shooting. Now, the shooting is anywhere from 105, 106. He put it this way. He's dead at the hospital at 115. He's dead at the hospital at 1:15. He's dead at the hospital. So whatever happened, he's at the hospital, and they originally wrote 107 on the death certificate, and they typed over that 1:15. So everybody is monkeying around, Dallas police, FBI, with this timeline, trying to get Oswald from his rooming house to the shooting and then get him to the theater and figure this whole thing out. And no matter how many times they jigger this thing, it doesn't work out. And in here lies an incredible amount of corruption and framing of Oswald. Keep in mind, this is literally 30 minutes after the assassination. The assassination is 12:35, right? At 1 o'clock, he's in his rooming house. At 1:15, Tippit is dead. Think about what you just did for the past 45 minutes of your life. Imagine You're shooting the president. You come down six flights of stairs. You live about 5 miles away. Somehow you get home with a multitude of buses and all this traffic with
cars. He also casually bought like a Coke and some other stuff.
Yeah, the Coke, he drinks it down. He's seen by the motorcycle cop and the manager of the building. He's calm as a cucumber. He leaves the building and somehow gets home at 1 o'clock and puts on his coat. May or may not have taken his gun. That's kind of debatable also. And ends up going 30 minutes later. He ends up at the Texas Theater. That's what we do know. And maybe he's supposed to meet somebody there. Maybe he's just going to see the movie. I don't really know. You know, and he sits in the back. But that's his timeline, his personal timeline. What they're trying to do is have him literally walk fast, because if he was jogging, so many people would have seen him running through the streets for a mile. That would have been insane. So they walk. Everyone who's tried this cannot do it over the years. Everyone has tried to walk this distance in 4 minutes, you know, 5 minutes, 6 minutes, couldn't pull it off.
Well, I can tell you, I've run, been a runner, and I walk, and I can say I'm over 6 feet tall and a fast walker.
Right.
In a mile, it's a bit of a huff to get, get a mile in at 13 minutes or so.
Right. And yeah, he's
do not it, running. But it's tricky.
It is tricky, right? Warren Reynolds follows him along this, whoever he's following, follows him along. And when the police interview Warren Reynolds, he can't identify Lee Harvey Oswald as the man with the gun after the shooting, roaming along East Jefferson Boulevard before he gets into the theater. So Warren Reynolds, 2 days later, gets shot in the head in his car dealership by a rifle. The bullet goes through his temple. He miraculously recovers and tells police he can now fully identify Lee Harvey Oswald. My favorite witness in the entire Kennedy assassination is Warren Reynolds. He completely got the message, completely turned around.
And he saw the light.
He saw the light.
Supporters of the Warren Report would have to disregard any parts of the story that imply that there was an intentional Oswald lookalike, including the man running out of the back of the school book depository building, getting into the Nash Rambler in Dealey Plaza right after the shooting, the Ralph Yates FBI report and story, the Dobbs House FBI report and story, the Texas Theater rear exit story, the shooting range stories from Dr. Homer Wood and his son Sterling Wood, and mechanic T.F. White seeing someone in a parked car who looked identical to Oswald after we know that Oswald was already in custody by the Dallas police. And you'd have to think that it is a mere coincidence that the license plate of the parked car is then traced to a military contractor who is close friends with slain Dallas police officer J.D. Tippit. As a defender of the Warren Report, you would need to believe that Jack Ruby went to the Western Union office, which happened to be next to the police station, to help his employee with a wire transfer, even though the employee was getting paid the next day. And it just happened to be about the same time as Lee Harvey Oswald was being transferred. If you like what you hear every week and want to learn more about the assassination, please pick up my book, The End of Innocence, The Assassination of President John F. Kennedy. It's available right now on Amazon, or you can find it at www.endofinnocencejfk.com. In honor of the release of the JFK assassination records, I'm sending out signed copies of my book. If you would like one of these, please email me at endofinnocencejfk@gmail.com. The price is $40 for the soft cover and $60 for the hardcover, plus shipping and handling. I can promise you won't be disappointed in the book. It's an oversized coffee table style book. The book is over 500 pages with almost 1,000 pictures. You won't be disappointed. And hey, send me your comments about the book or this podcast at endofinnocencejfk@gmail.com. We'll see you next week.